Bill Bennett is here first with what's happening in the world of tech. Good morning.
Good morning.
We touched on the Optus hack yesterday with our Australia correspondent, but goodness, it looks like things have got even worse. A lot of people affected.
Oh, yeah. It's probably, I mean, it's not the biggest hack ever, but it's the biggest one in our region. And in terms of, you know, the percentage of people in Australia who are affected, it's huge. I mean, the attacker's got 10 million people's data. In fact, I think it was 9.7 or something similar million people's data, which is, you know, around about 35, 36, 37% of the Australian population. But, you know, bearing in mind that babes in arms and so on don't have mobile phones, that's probably even higher percentage of people that have mobile phones. So it's huge in terms of its scope. It's not so huge in terms of the details that the attackers got hold of. We know they got names, dates of birth, phone numbers, email addresses. And for a large subset of customers, they got other information which Optus used to verify people's identity. You know, if you want to, say, change your phone number or whatever, you need to give a little bit more detail to identify yourself. And that includes ID documents like driver's licenses, passport numbers, and most serious of all is the Medicare cards that people have in Australia. And those things, the data that they have, it doesn't allow the attackers or the people who the attackers will sell the data to, because that's very much the model that works in that kind of hacking these days. It doesn't allow them to access things like bank accounts and so on. So people aren't going to get robbed that way. But what it does, there's two parts to this. The first is that the potential for identity theft is just huge. I mean, if you've got those names and you can match names, dates of birth and so on with the identity documents, then those identity documents, in effect, become worthless as identity documents in future, because, you know, you can pretend to be Catherine Ryan going to get a bank account or a mortgage or whatever. So that's one way in which it's really worrying. But the other way that it's really worrying is because they can get hold of things like driver's licenses, passport numbers, and Medicare numbers, they can get to know more about someone for what's known as social engineering attacks. So, you know, they may know, for example, by looking at data, just a little bit more about you, so that when someone comes on the phone or approaches you in public to try and con you, they can reveal things, or they would have access to levers to be able to influence you that they wouldn't otherwise have. So that's the real concern about the danger of the attack to the individuals. But the way the whole thing happened the way the story unfolded was quite interesting, because at first it looked like Optus had done all the right things. You know, late last week, Optus was getting lots of praise for having been really quick to come out and say that there'd been this attack, and they were praised for their transparency as a company. But that soon started to look quite different, because two things. One thing is the attack happened, or at least Optus knew about it, very late on Wednesday last week, and the CEO apparently was told about it Wednesday evening. Thursday last week was Australia's National Day of Mourning, so in effect a public holiday, and because they're Australians, I mean, I'm sure New Zealanders would do exactly the same thing. Most people took Thursday and Friday as leave, and so it was in effect a long weekend. So the Optus comms team managed to slip that out at the start of a long weekend, where to a degree it could be kept out of the more intense parts of the news cycle. And that may or may not have been accidental. I mean, there's some suspicion that it wasn't. And Optus only went public with the news after a story about the hack had appeared in the media anyway. So what, at first, the company was looking really good and it was looking like they did all the right things. As time has gone on, increasingly, it looks like they really haven't. When they first broke the news, they told the media that they were the victims of a sophisticated attack, which must have been put together by some really clever people in organised crime or perhaps state actors, which is code for another government attacking Australian data. It turns out that it wasn't anything of the sort. It was a really, really basic hack. It was, in effect, the people looking after the security on Optus's data had, in effect, left the window open for burglars to climb through. So it was a really simple attack. And then there's the question of why would Optus keep all that potentially damaging personal ID information, like the Medicare numbers and so on. They need to get that information from their customers in order to verify someone's identity, so they can, for example, give them a new SIM card or a new phone number or whatever. But once that's done, they don't need that information anymore. So the best practice nowadays for companies that get that kind of ID information is they keep it for a very short time, and then they discard it so that it can't be used in the way that the fear is that's happening with Optus.
This is not the first time we've heard this story, though, where historic data has not been deleted, and it seems to be more than one organisation's a bit tardy about doing that. It's a biggie, all right. It's a biggie. What's your take on Onesie, as some have dubbed it? Vodafone's name change to One New Zealand or One NZ sparked huge debate. Quite a few humorous memes. I do like Onesie. I think that could work for them. It's funny, isn't it, when we go through everything from sort of the Te Papa thumbprint to Sparks Asterix, which was amusingly used. I can't remember what. They had some big issue early on, Sparks, some big kind of public relations disaster, and someone put out a poster that was F and then the two Spark asterisks and then a K, which was on our wall in our office quite a while. We go through this kind of torturous process of a rebrand, and then eventually you tend to sort of get used to them, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I mean,
sometimes it's just everyone says, "I kind of thought of that." What do you make of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first thing is it's an incredibly anodyne name. It's really boring and dull. But then corporations tend to do that. They needed to change the name. I mean, it wasn't Spark changed the name from Telecom to Spark because they wanted to look younger and funkier and so on and attract a younger demographic to the brand, and who felt that Telecom was a sort of old person's brand. So that was an understandable marketing move. Vodafone have very, very even better reason to change their name, and that is that Vodafone is no longer part of Vodafone. It's the Vodafone Group in the UK is the parent company. They licensed the name to the New Zealand operation now, since they sold it a couple of years ago to Infratil and Brookfield Asset Management. So they did need to change that name because it's costing them so much money every year to pay for it. It's rather like you pay for a KFC franchise, and you have to pay KFC in the US to own that brand name in New Zealand. So it's by changing their name, they're going to save themselves a lot of money. But also they did have an issue with they do need to look more like a New Zealand business. And, of all the three big telcos, Spark, Vodafone and 2degrees, Vodafone was the one that just didn't look like a New Zealand company. So for those reasons, I think it's good that they needed to do this. It's good that they've done it, and they've done it in a way that I think all the fuss that we talked about earlier, I think that's going to go reasonably quickly, like it did with Spark. As you say, for about a year or so, Spark's name was a bit controversial, and then very quickly that died down. There is a particular problem. There's two problems with the name for people in New Zealand. The first one, of course, is the confusion with TVNZ, which is, you know, the TV One brand, which
I wonder
looks,
if that's overstated. You think of One News. It's either TV One or it's One News, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure that yeah. I people and, you know, brand experts have pointed out that as an issue, but
yeah, and no one's gonna make that confusion. No one's gonna go into a Vodafone shop and ask why the news program last night was awful or whatever. It's just not gonna happen. That's you know, the confusion there is minimal, and I don't think there's anything to worry about. The thing about the far right political connotations of the name, particularly more there is a political party called One New Zealand. But it's in effect dead. I mean, it hasn't been active for a long time now, and it's more that the connection, people thinking of One New Zealand and One Australia, the right wing party
there's New Zealand First. Someone, well, I don't know whether they were just trolling or not, just joking online, talking about how it could have been First New Zealand, inverting New Zealand First. The thing is, you want the name to do two things. You want the name to be something where everyone instantly knows it's you, and there's no confusion over that. And second, where it is at least not presenting something offensive or confusing as a message.
Yes.
And so that's why you're getting these immediate reactions, I guess. The point is whether it just calms down over time and everyone gets used to the symbol, and that's kind of it.
It's yesterday's Twitter. I mean, it's going to calm down really quickly, and I don't think the company has anything to apologise for about the name. I don't think it was insensitive. Maybe they could have checked to see if anyone was using
What does it mean, though? I mean, I don't know how much a brand ever has to mean anything. I don't know why Spark and an asterisk means anything to me, but Spark is an easy name to remember. Well, it is, you know, it's kind of monosyllabic and you know. Stuff was an interesting one when the Dominion Post newspapers and all the allied newspapers around the country became Stuff. But then it's a simple, straightforward kind of catch-all term.
And that's quite deliberate. I mean, the reason why it's called One New Zealand and not something like, you know, something phone or whatever, which where Vodafone comes from, is because that becomes limiting. Because if you have the word phone in your name, you're a phone company.
I get that. It's just the one thing.
Yeah,
short.
I think it's bland and unimaginative, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
All right. Okay, it is an important transition, though, because there's a lot of business that you want to immediately, or a lot of customers you want to immediately associate your new brand with the service you hope they continue to want to have.
I think that's a problem. The other thing that's a problem, I think, that hasn't really been discussed, and it was a problem for Spark when they rebranded but only for a few months, was try Googling One.
Good point.
You know, if you're good.
Yeah, but then if you have an unusual word, no one can remember what it is or how to spell it.
No, but
you
own it on Google.
All right, let's just do one more. Which one do you most want to do next?
I think we should talk about the church app.
Oh yes, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a trend amongst the Baptist churches, particularly the Baptist churches the Southern Baptist churches in the US, to ask their members to install phone monitoring software to stop them engaging in I'm going to open the brackets here, sinful, close the brackets, behaviour. And basically that means looking at porn, really. I mean, it can be other things, but it's really about porn. Oh, and to a degree about things that the more religious right don't approve of, like, you know, perhaps people may have gay tendencies, and they may be closeted because they're, you know, because the culture of those churches. But the moment they go off and look at a gay website or whatever, their pastor will know about that. It's the most popular piece of software that does this. Has some AI built in, so it can detect when you look at a photo on your phone screen, it can tell that that's a photo of someone
naked.
No,
people.
Yes,
it can see bits, Bill.
Yeah, or even people having...
relations.
You know, relationships, yes. It can do all of that. And the moment that happens, the moment you see something like that on your phone, your pastor or your... Now, what do they call them? They don't call them spiritual advisors. They call them your accountability partner.
Oh, my Lord.
Right, so you have to nominate someone who's your accountability partner. And that's basically a church elder, usually. And that person will get an email report on what you've been looking at, and if the software thinks it's particularly serious, they'll get a text message saying, you know, get round there now and have a word with this person.
Are people voluntarily signing up for this?
Well, yes and no. There's two types of people that are using it. The first is that if you work for one of these churches, remember these churches are huge businesses. They have large numbers of employees, and you know, they have retail stores and so on. Anyone who's a church employee has to have this software as part of their contract. It's part of the deal. The other thing is that if you are a church member and you go to a pastor or one of the elders in your Baptist church and you say, you know, I'm having impure thoughts or anything like that, they'll say,
sorry. Carry on, Bill.
Yeah, install this software on your phone.
Someone just made a gesture through the window, and that's what made me laugh. Carry on.
Yeah, well, you just know where this is all
going.
Most
people have impure thoughts every 15 seconds, I think, is one statistic. Anyway.
Yeah, I think if you don't, you've got a problem. But
yeah. Anyway, if you're sprung, this gets reported back to your accountability advisor. I don't know what happens if your accountability advisor gets sprung. It's going to bring a whole new meaning to the word burnerphone in some ways, isn't it? And perhaps burnerphones with data might be the new thing.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is the thing about it that isn't really widely discussed is it does mean that your accountability partners get to know a lot more about you than you might want anyway. So even if you are squeaky clean in the context of the Southern Baptist Church, they're still going to know that, you know, you did something they don't like. Like, maybe you went to the pub or you went to, you know, placed a bet on a sports event or something. You know what I mean? It can start to become really intrusive. And it's...
Okay. Covenant Eyes will not be being downloaded from the iTunes store or anywhere else. Bill, don't know about you. Can we just quickly finish? I'm quite curious about your next one, just to finish. Remote work and productivity theatre. Of course, there's often the standoff of workers. Well, that's a massive assumption, so excuse it, but I just made it. Workers saying, oh, no, we're far more productive at home, and then bosses saying, how do we know? So what's productivity theatre, please?
Well, look, basically, it's... The bosses can monitor what you do on your phones and your computers and so on at home. So people are doing silly things like they're wiggling their mouse every few minutes, or they're logging into Zoom calls and Teams calls that they don't really need to be on. But they're doing all sorts of things just to show their boss that they're busy, because if they don't, their boss thinks they're not being busy. And it's a bit like the... control freak bosses, you know, like to have all their people out working on the in the floor where they can look out at from a window and see everyone with their head down working. And, you know, really what they're doing is they've got their heads down and they're listening to music or, reading the newspaper or doing the crossword or something. But it's just a different form of productivity theatre where you have to appear to be working online now, and that, you know, you may even be like just typing nonsense characters in the keyboard, but the keyboard monitoring gear that the bosses have will be registering, oh yeah, Bill's typing at the moment, he's working. And it's just a crazy thing. But the problem is that people are spending so much time on productivity theatre that productivity is actually dropping.
Oh, from the weird and wonderful, part two. Perhaps we just all stop spying on each other and get on with things. Maybe that's the theme of the session today, Bill.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Much appreciated. Bill Bennett, tech commentator,